Suddenly I'm Miss Midwest Midnight Checkout Queen. Until I head home and I put myself to bed.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Add him on my whoa, whoa, Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Tom Kramer. His show, Journey to the Third Dimension, is on now through December 29th at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art in Eugene on the campus of the University of Oregon. Thanks for coming to KBOO,
Tom. Well, thank you for having me, Joseph.
Listeners might not know, but you actually hosted the show a few times between Julie Bernard and Ava Lake.
Yes, I did, in fact. Mainly, I substituted for Julie Bernard, and this is a very interesting fact, but I actually was Julie's first guest in her absolutely first Art Focus show, which I think was in like 1986 or something.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And
then after I got to know her a little bit, and she asked me to sub for her once in a while. So,
what was that, 80, what year?
I think it might have been 1986. I think the other guy was Marco Polo, who was we had a show together at the University of Portland, you know.
So in those days, what were you doing? I mean, were you doing those cars that people see around town?
I was doing the
black dividers.
Right, yeah, that's how I sort of, that's one of the ways I got well known, I guess. I did a lot of cars. Portland was a very different town back then, much less populated and not really on the map, and kind of like a big Astoria almost. And it was very easy to get by. Everything was really inexpensive, and everybody knew everybody else.
Did you live then?
I lived in an apartment in Southeast Portland, and I had a really kind of a great landlord who basically traded for about 8 years for my art, so I didn't pay any rent for a long time. I was able to save up a bunch of money and then buy my house later in Northeast, which is now really booming. But I've kept up that same track by now the car thing is kind of more now manifested in the murals that I do around town.
Yeah, so people would know your murals around town. This show, though, is very different. This is a mixture of recent work. A lot of it is carved and painted wood, and then early drawings from the 70s. And there's a catalog written by Richard Speer. The essay is written by Richard Speer, and it talks about how the drawings and the paintings influence each other back and forth.
Right. I started drawing in actually 1973. I was really involved with music in the earlier part of my life. Classical music, for that is. And I took music theory classes. I didn't understand a word of it, so I was bored. So I doodled a lot, and that's sort of how the art got started, basically through music. And that's a thread that also is run through my entire life, which is I'm heavily influenced by music almost more than I am by other art, which is a strange thing to say, but I'm really interested in the idea of taking something. For example, Monet and Debussy are very similar in their content. One is a composer, and one is a visual artist. So the idea of taking a cross fertilization of different things, and that jumps right into I read Marshall McLuhan, who talked about the medium is the message. And one of the things that Richard, the curator, really captured well in the show, I think, is that you know, drawings are one thing, but what they lead to is quite another. In other words, you can have an idea in a drawing, and where it leads to, it can, the same idea can look very different in the final result, whether it be a carving or a painting or a mural, whatever, depending on, so the context of what you're doing is one thing, and then the content is another thing, you know.
So in Eugene now, this show, you go up the main stairs and, you know, you pay your money at the counter there and you turn left. There's a little collection of rooms that you've got. and then there are some of the more recent stuff is right there in your face. One of them is called The Politics of Experience. So it's a big carved piece. It looks mainly gold. It's more kind of smooth where you've carved it less, I guess, and at the bottom it's much more deep. I would say to listeners, all Portlanders have probably seen a Tom Cramer somewhere. These are either round or rectangular, big pieces of wood that are, you know, you use wood as the canvas, but you carve deeply into it, and it's kind of like a crocodile pattern or a cracked mud, that kind of thing you'd see in a drought.
Right.
And then you color it. And you do, you know, these are brightly colored, but there are different hues, and then you often use gold leaf. So just tell us about this one, The Politics of Experience.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say about The Politics of Experience is that I read the book called The Politics of Experience by R.D. Lang, and he was a very renowned Scottish, British psychiatrist who, among others, treated Roger Waters. One of the essays in this book, it's a series of essays, was Us and Them, and later, of course, Waters used that in Dark Side of the Moon, but that's an aside. It's a book that really blew me away. It's very, doesn't date. He really talks about the fundamental issues of what it's like, you know, what modern, postmodern life is sort of like. So I thought, I've really got to do something to, in appreciation for him, who is now dead. By the way, he did come to Portland, I think, in the late 80s and gave a lecture, which is interesting. But anyway, the piece is extremely symphonic. Those big wood relief pieces that I do, I relate strongly to, like, Bruckner or later Beethoven symphonies, where there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of steps involved in, you know, achieving the final result. Obviously, a drawing, I've said this a few times, but a drawing is like one person playing an acoustic guitar. It's a very direct line between the brain and the final product, whereas a carving, you know, it's step after step after step, layer after layer after layer. It's like the most complicated French cooking you can imagine, or whatever. You know, the French are known for their very complicated cuisine. So, I mean, it's a very, especially those big ones are, you know, are months and months and months of step after step after step.
Just tell us the first few steps. You get a big piece of wood, plane it down, draw on it, and then cut where the drawing marks are?
Yeah, great question. The first step is the drawing, you know, as Richard just sort of discovered and I became aware of, that I usually do a drawing and then later say, well, that drawing's pretty, that would work well for the idea I want to do. So then, indeed, I often, and sometimes not, but I always draw on the block to some extent. Whether I draw on the entire block is not known until I start working, but usually I draw an area and then I, you know, carve it out and then do another area, carve that out, do another area and carve that out. Very rarely do I map the entire thing out in advance. That would be sort of not that interesting to me. However, there are other times when literally the drawing is with the knife. And in the case of The Politics Experience, I think it's probably the only piece in that show that the entire middle part of the carving is done only with a knife, you know. And that was done completely in an improvised manner, kind of like East Indian music, Ravi Shankar sitar music, where there's definitely a box within which I am able to, you know, create the piece. I put sort of mental parameters on what forms I'm going to work with, and then within that limitation, I improvise. You know,
what kind of knife do you use?
Yeah, good question. I use the knives I use come from either Switzerland, Germany, or England. And Henry Taylor in the case of England, and Swiss Made in the case of Switzerland, and Two Cherries in the case of Germany. I have, in the case of the knives, I am unable to get the edge that I want, so that I have them professionally sharpened to the extreme level of surgical edge.
Yeah, but you're not using a hammer and a chisel. You're using
like
sheath knives or pocket knives? Or
No, I use what's called, they're called bench knives, and you can get them from like Woodcraft Inc. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just basically carving knives for the purpose of carving. And then the outer parts of the Politics of Experience, that piece was done with a chisel and a mallet. And so in other words, the interior part was done with a knife. The exterior part was done with a mallet and a chisel, and that gives you a more textured, incisive, aggressive, in-your-face look.
So when you say interior, you mean towards the edge of the rectangle, the grooves are deeper and the colors are brighter because the way you finished it.
Right.
Towards the middle, it kind of looks like when you smooth out tin foil from a bar of chocolate, you know, you're trying to smooth it out so it's perfectly,
right,
but there's a few wrinkles in
it.
So, and that's a common thing in your work, that there are sort of dents and divots, and it's kind of like a landscape.
Right.
There are dips and that you've put in, and they're not symmetrical. They can occur anywhere.
Right. One thing, that analogy that a lot of people can understand pretty easily, is if you look at a tree up close, you're aware of the bark and the texture of the bark and the undulations in the bark. When you go back from that same tree, it's just a brown stripe. You know, you don't see any texture or very little texture. So in a sense, the interior part of that piece elicits the idea of distance, and the towards the edges, it's more like up front. So hopefully there's a dimensionality going on in some of those pieces.
So before we finish with that piece, the Politics of Experience, how do you take a complicated book and give it some kind of treatment as a painting or a work of art?
Well, that's a very good question. It's more the idea of something being a challenge, you know, something, and the very fact that you can't really do that is why I was interested in doing it, because I was so affected by that book. It sort of was one of those books that changed my life, along with other people like Alan Watts and so forth.
Who's Alan Watts?
Alan Watts is another British guy who was very good at teaching Eastern religions and Zen Buddhism and so forth. Worth checking out. He moved to California in probably the 30s, and was first involved with Christianity and sort of radical Christianity, and then that morphed into his interest in Buddhism and Hinduism and so forth. And his books don't date either at all. He's a great, fantastic figure.
So you saw this as a challenge. Book I like, I'm going to do some art.
Right. And that's the same sort of effect happened with, I don't know if you want to talk about Moon Lake, but that's another piece that was inspired by, in that case, an actual place that I visited. There's a lake in the Austrian Alps called Moon Lake in English. It's Mondsee in German. And I got off the bus on this tour, and I was just completely blown out of my mind by the vibe I felt being in this small town near this big lake. And it was indeed very otherworldly, a very otherly place. It's between Vienna and Salzburg. And then it really stuck with me, and I said, you know, I really got to do, plus that's such a great title, Moon Lake, you know, such a great idea for the mind, right? That I decided I'm going to do another piece based on that.
Was it based on the mountains around the lake, or the surface of the water, or the sky reflecting? Well, because the piece Moon Lake is a big bluish purple circle with dimples, kind of like a big golf ball.
Right. Well, I think that what sealed the deal for me is finding out that many other people were also affected by this place. I wasn't the only one.
Does it have some kind of mystical property?
I think it does.
Hippies go there and...
Well, you know, it's not so much like Glastonbury in Britain, which is very much a hippie place. You know, that's a good question. It could be... I don't know whether it is. I do know that Wagner, Beethoven, Mozart, all those guys who were in some ways the original hippies did go there. And there is one sort of German hippie named Klaus Schulze. I don't know if you know who that is. He's an electronic music pioneer that actually wrote a piece recently called Moon Lake, you know, he vacations there. So that kind of sealed the deal. I'm a big Klaus Schulze fan. So that kind of catalyzed me into saying, well, now I really have to do it. And the reason we are, I assume, bringing this up is that usually I don't base pieces prior to going there. In other words, usually I just do my thing and then figure out what it's about after I'm already done. But in these cases, I had known beforehand what I wanted to do. Or
before you even got to the lake?
No, not before I got to the lake. No, that's not true. I went to the lake, was really inspired, and said, I've got to do something about this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that happens all the time. We're always affected by where we visit, you know. And usually it takes months for me to, like, process it afterwards, you know.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You are listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Tom Kramer. His show Journey to the Third Dimension is on now at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art in Eugene at the U of O, and it closes on December 29th. So Moon Lake, is round, but you sometimes work with circles within a rectangle. Tell us about this piece, Attraction.
Yeah, well, that piece is actually the kind of, in some ways, the reverse of Moon Lake compositionally, because it's a rectangular piece that converges into a round piece, right? So that piece is, of all the pieces in the show, this show, it's certainly the most optically oriented. It's very op-oriented, almost like...
Yeah, I would say it's like looking into the head of a sunflower. The seeds are receding. Or looking down a well, actually, that's constructed of bricks, traditional kind of fairy tale well. And then at the very edge of the canvas, you know, the rectangle... The chunks are really big, so there's a lot of perspective here, and the center is dipped down, right? It's, you know, a few inches below the edge. Is that correct?
Right.
And then the whole thing's gold. It's like gold leaf gone crazy.
Yeah, I think that your comment about relating to a sunflower is very astute, because I think one of the things I'm really interested in my work is the microcosmic and macrocosmic aspect of, sometimes I think the poet Blake said, you know, the ability to see heaven in a wildflower, I think that's his quote, is then you understand the nature of the entire universe. In other words, there's really no, our scale is pretty much arbitrary how we view everything. If we're a bug crawling around in grass, the grass is an old growth forest. If we're I think that the attraction thing could also be related to a cosmic or some orb or a redshift aspect in, you know, the universe as well. So there's that film by Charles Eames did a film where
the chair guy?
Yeah, the chair guy. He also did some experimental films, short films, and this one was about how the camera pans way into somebody's arm, and
And so they show it in middle schools still.
Sure, I think they probably do.
You zoom in and you zoom out.
Yeah, so I think that idea is there with the piece Attraction.
Mm-hmm. Attraction meaning like celestial bodies attraction, or humans?
Well, you know, I did a series of those pieces that are really similar, and that one I called Attraction. It's attraction as in gravity, something that pulls you in, something that, like a magnetic force or something that stimulates your curiosity, attraction in that sense, not so much any other, you know.
So as you walk around the room, the U of O, then you come across a lot of drawings and some paintings, and there's a group of three together. They're just untitled, and it's two people, one slightly behind the other. I think it's a man and a woman. And you just sort of, you know, they're in color, and you just use them, group them together three times. Now, who are these people, and why did you use it three of them?
Well, first of all, I didn't curate the show, and I don't know. You'd have to ask the curator that question, why he picked the drawings that he picked. I think part
was that
of
Richard?
It, yes,
Richard
I think
Spear?
He
chose, as well as writing the essay, he curated.
He did. He's both the writer of the essay and the curator. And I think part of what he achieved was showing how some of the drawings in the show were not intended to be shown as finished drawings. They're just idea generation kind of things, and maybe half the drawings in the show are more finished drawings. So I think he's trying to show how all of us, I assume, are interested when you look at a work of art. You want to know, well, how did they arrive at this finished product? You know, what's the process? And I think this show, first of all, the museum, the Jordan Schnitzer Museum, is a different than our or most art museums in that it's a teaching museum. It's a museum that's it's one of its missions is to teach students down there how things happen. In this case, you know, how do you go from point A to point B, being the finished product? So some of the drawings aren't necessarily my best drawings, or even, but they are. They do show the sort of raw beginnings of how ideas are beginning in a sort of a pedagogical manner.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a piece called Untitled 2012, and it is very Tom Kramer. It's bright reds and yellows, a lot of kind of worms and snakes and leaves and pointy bits. It's a square with a black border, and then every color is divided by a thick black line. And at the bottom there's a crown upside down. Why didn't you give it a title?
I think there actually was a title that they didn't look at it. I think it's something like musical interior.
Oh, okay.
I kind of title things like throwing a dart at a dictionary. I don't really. I like Magritte a lot for titles. He'll just title things completely arbitrarily, like a guy with an apple in front of him. It's called The Human Condition. Well, I don't know why he called it that, and he probably doesn't either. So I took some of the surrealist idea where, I mean,
first thought, best thought.
Yeah, sort of the Jack Kerouac idea. I mean, they're a big influence on me, too, the Beat Generation, you know, for sure. But on that piece, it's as hard as it is for some people to explain. That was a painting. I think you nailed it in what you just said. That's one of the few more recent pieces where that was done in one take with no editing, which is very difficult to do. Usually you do something and then you realize, oh, a lot of what I did didn't work, and I have to redo it and redo it and redo it. So that piece was just an automatic, you know, one of those rare times when you feel really inspired, like 100%.
Was it acrylics?
No, I don't use. The only time I use acrylics is when I do murals. I definitely prefer oil paint over acrylics.
These bright primary colors are oil.
Yeah,
and they'll stay that way for a few decades.
I have no idea. You know. I mean, I don't care for, you know, working in plastic, which is what. You know, acrylics are basically plastic. What's that?
Because of the environment?
No. Well, I mean, that would be a side issue. I personally don't really know how to use acrylics effectively. They're okay if you don't build the paint up. I don't mind them, which is why I use them in murals. They're a lot easier.
You know. So they're all right for like one level.
I think so. And that probably could have been successful in acrylic. You're right, but.
Yeah, it's a bit flatter than, you know, literally flatter than your
One of the things about me is in my training, my art teachers were older and of an earlier generation. And those guys, they didn't work in acrylics. They worked in oil. So I was trained in oil painting, you know. And
Dark brown is a very big one, and it looks like a giant crocodile handbag to me. It's just brown and wrinkly and dark. You know, it's just got this very heavy feel to it. It's lit in the museum from above. I mean, you've got to light this thing, otherwise it'd be invisible. Do these pieces end up in people's hallways and living rooms? Have you seen them out in the natural world? You know, the natural habitat of the art collector.
I've certainly seen dark brown because I know who owns it.
Who's that?
And a guy named Edwin Gruba owns it.
Does he live in Portland?
He lives in Portland, and
why did he buy it?
I have no idea. You know, maybe it was because I know that he and I share a like or love for Miles Davis, the musician, and that piece was sort of a slight homage on my part to Miles Davis.
Really? And what's Miles Davis-y about this?
Boy, that would be something that I couldn't even answer.
Were you listening at the time?
I listened to a lot of his music all the time. And for some reason, when I was done with the piece, it reminded me of him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure he was the nicest person and as a person, but I love his music. In some ways, he's sort of like the Beethoven of jazz or something, you know.
Hmm.
And
that's really interesting.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I need to add on this, sometimes when you ask people something, they don't know what the answer is. And in that case, I don't always know myself what my own motivations are. It's sort of the concept, you can't really know anybody else, and sometimes you don't even know yourself and why you do what you do. So you can't really understand people that well or yourself that well sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes even yourself is sort of a mystery, you know.
The title of the show is Journey to the Third Dimension.
Mm-hmm.
What's the third dimension? Isn't that just like the z-axis on a graph?
Well, again, I didn't title it that. That's Richard, the curator's title, you know.
I thought, as I was reading his essay, maybe you two had gone to Burning Man together and done a bunch of DMT or something. But apparently, I saw him last night, and he said, you've never been to Burning Man. And
you know, I probably wouldn't go, even if somebody paid me. I have absolutely no interest in going to Burning Man. If anything, I like to avoid people rather than be around them, because I find people very difficult to be around. I prefer to live sort of in my own world.
What did you do for the eclipse?
I was here in town.
Yeah?
And I just, you know, went and
stuck your head out of the window for 10 minutes. You didn't go on a journey.
I did not. The thing is, I think there's a writer, I think it was H.L. Davis, wrote The Honey and the Horn, and he said that when the pioneers first came out here, the sight of other people was really great and really welcoming, and he noticed now in the modern age, people tend to find other people a form of aggravation and anxiety and judgment and mental illness and so forth, and I think he was on to something. In other words, I like people and I like being around people, but I also need space away from them to process what I just experienced and so forth.
It's funny, isn't it? The current luxuries now, the things that you pay extra for, are being away from the internet, being on your own, being thin and healthy, and then having some kind of real community, you know, real people that you see rather than online.
I think you're right. In fact, I remember this tour guide said in the old days only the rich people had cell phones. Now only the rich people don't have cell phones, you know, or something like that.
Is this going to help your work, reflecting on it like this today?
Well, you ask, I like talking to you because you ask questions that other people wouldn't ask, and some of your observations are you know, outside of the box kind of observations. But it was really thought-provoking, and I really appreciate it.
One last question.
Sure.
How do you clean these things?
Clean what?
The paintings with all the little grooves.
You know, a feather duster or a, you know, like blow
compressed
the dust
air.
Off. What's that?
Compressed air.
Yeah,
like
that would probably
keyboard.
be worth a good way to do it, right.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Tom Kramer. His show, Journey to the Third Dimension, is on now through December 29th at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art in Eugene on the campus of the University of Oregon. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Tom.
It was great meeting you, Joseph. Thank you very much. See you.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Add him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
Have you ever wondered how a radio station works? Find out by joining KBOO's engineering committee. Or, do you have a radio, electrical, or audio engineering background and are looking for a good way to use those skills for good? Join KBOO's engineering committee. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The next engineering committee will meet Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll show the documentary film The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Cave is a story of female doctors saving lives in a secret underground hospital in Syria. The film follows the women as they contend with daily bombardments, chronic supply shortages, and the ever-present threat of chemical attacks. It paints a stirring portrait of courage, resilience, and female solidarity. Again, that's The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522.